So this is August the 2nd, 1922, in volume 14. The heading is Likeness to Jesus in His Greatest Pain, the Abandonment of the Divinity in His Sufferings. This is a very important thing that's going to be given to us now. Louisa said, finding myself in my usual state, I saw myself all confused and as though separated from my sweet Jesus, to the point that as he came, I said to him, my love, how things have changed for me. She's been saying that since volume two. Before, I used to feel so identified with you that I felt no division between you and me. And in the very pains I suffered, you were with me. Now, Louise's problem is that life changes. I presume you're not the person you were 10 years ago. And the difficulty we have is to identify that the Lord has brought about a particular change and what it means and where it's going. That's what Louise is actually dealing with. Okay, so the subject is really discernment. All right. And she said, you used to be with me also in the pains. Now it's the complete opposite. And I suffer, I feel separated from you. Now, she's one with him in the divine will and it's permanent. So how can she feel separated? That's what's going to be explained to her. Okay. I feel separated from you. And if I see you before me or inside me, it is the appearance of a judge who condemns me to the penalty, that is to death. And you no longer take part in the pains that you yourself give me. And yet you say to me, rise more and more, she said, while I am descending. So here's a title for the next paragraph, The Interior Passion, Spiritual Suffering. Now, spiritual suffering is very difficult, and it's also difficult to name and to really know what's going on. So Jesus interrupted me and said, my daughter, how you are deceiving yourself, because this isn't the reality. This is happening because you accepted and I marked in you the deaths and the pains which I suffered for every creature. So she's going through something that he went through. My humanity too found itself in these painful conditions. It was inseparable from my divinity. And since my divinity was untouchable by pains, nor capable of suffering any shadow of pain, my humanity found itself alone in suffering, while my divinity was only the spectator of the pains and the deaths which I suffered. Now, beside that, I want you to put Matthew 27:46. Matthew 27:46. My God, why have you deserted me? Because that was the moment when the divinity left his humanity to take the brunt. Okay. Even more, the divinity was my inexorable judge who wanted to be paid the penalty for each pain of each creature. That's the bit that's almost impossible to take on board. Each pain of each creature. Oh, how my humanity trembled, he said. I remained crushed before the supreme light and majesty in seeing myself covered with the sins of all. That is the meaning of Louisa feeling separated. That if she's making reparation for the sins and the pains of human beings, then she's standing before divine justice. And there is the gulf between divine justice and sin. Okay. I should say between God and sin. So divine justice has got to be appeased. But that was exactly the position of Jesus on the cross. So he said, in seeing myself covered with the sins of all and with the pains and deaths that each one deserved. Okay. That's why he said, I remained crushed. It was the greatest pain of my life that while I was one with the divinity and inseparable from it, in the pains I remained alone and as though apart. So he stands in the breach between divine justice and human sin. Okay, and he's got to stand there. So standing in the breach is Psalm 106, and I can't remember the verse right now, but I gave you that reference before, but it's Psalm 106. And you're told in Psalm 106 that if Moses hadn't stood in the breach, that divine justice would have wiped out the people. Okay. And that intercession of Moses was on Mount Sinai. So since I have called you to my likeness, Jesus said, what is the wonder if while you feel me inside of you and you see me as the spectator of your pains, which I myself inflict upon you, and you feel as though separated from me. So it seems a contradiction until it is explained. Yet your pain is nothing but the shadow of mine. Now, her pain is nearly killing her. But that's because we're tiny little creatures and then he is the great one. And just as my humanity was never separated from the divinity, so I assure you that you are never separated from me. So in other words, the office you are carrying out does not affect your personal union with me. Is that okay? So let's say you have taken marriage vows and you have a particular job to do in an office, or you're running a business or whatever. It doesn't reflect on your relationship with your spouse. Your relationship with your spouse is one thing and the job you're doing is another. Louise has been shown that. So I assure you that you're never separated from me. These are the effects that you feel. But then more than ever do I form one single thing with you, because she's doing what Jesus did as well. So therefore have courage and faithfulness and don't fear. It's hard not to fear when you're suffering desperately. So August the 6th, 1922, my heading for this is God's ecosystem. And the whole subject here is balance. If we're the way God wants us to be, everything will be balanced. Everything in the universe is balanced. Okay. And when we don't interfere with this balance, everything that God has created will carry out its function. Okay. So Louisa said, I felt all immersed in the holy will of God. And my sweet Jesus on coming told me, my daughter, all things have equal weight for me. This is the balance in creation. The weight of heaven is equal for me to that of earth. My will contains perfect balance. So one of the things, this is one of the keys, okay, whereby you will know if you're going forward in the divine will, because people at a very early stage in a religious life can be quite unbalanced about things, like they'll do so many religious things that they'll neglect their families. Do you know what I mean? That's unbalanced. Now, if you are really in God's will, everything is balanced. And the more we go into God's will, the more balance that actually comes into us. And actually, the strange thing is, the less religious you look. That's the strange thing. You can look fierce religious at a very early stage. You know, do you remember that CD we all got a couple of years ago, you know, about the children talking about the gospel? And one of the children, she was only six, she said that John the Baptist was fierce, awful, holy.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah.
Give up your old sins, yeah. Now, people can look fierce, awful, holy at the very beginning of the religious life. And when they are very advanced, they can look perfectly normal and not look religious at all. And they won't talk religion, but the ones at the beginning will talk nothing else. So you'll be able to find out where they're at, you know. It's very interesting. You've got too much experience in the higher stages to need to talk about it all the time. In the lower stages, you're only getting your feet into the water. So balance is the big thing here in this text, okay. So my will contains perfect balance. So balance brings about order. Now, even the title of your book tells you that we're being drawn back into the order into which we were created. Is that right? So if our everything inside of us interiorly isn't brought more and more into order and balance, we're not making progress in divine will. So he said, balance brings regime. Now, a regime is a system of rules or a discipline, okay? So it's the divine discipline that comes into us. Utility, that's usefulness, okay? And harmony. Now, balance and harmony go together. All things harmonize together as if they were one single thing. Order brings equality. Equality brings likeness. And this is why there's so much harmony, order and likeness in the three divine persons, and they're interdependent. And these are all aspects of interdependence in the divine order. So harmony, order and likeness in the three divine persons, okay. And all created things are in perfect harmony. If they weren't, we would have shocking disasters. One is the support and the strength and the life of the other. If just one created thing disharmonized, all the others would tremble and end up in ruin. That's why I call it God's ecosystem. Everything is dependent on everything else, and everything needs everything else. And when everything is in its correct order, it all works. Okay. Only man moved away from us. And you know from the higher volumes that when Adam moved away from this divine order, that all heaven and earth shook. And the disasters that came out of it was unbelievable. So only man moved away from us from the balance of our will. Oh, how man tumbled, and from the highest place he fell into the deepest abyss. That's like falling off Mount Everest. In spite of my redemption, not all of the human family has returned to its original state. So this means that lots of people have not actually benefited from redemption because they've done nothing about it. Unfortunately, you might know names. This means that the gravest thing is to withdraw from the balance of our will. Now, if you actually just ring the number of times the word balance is used in this entire text, you'll realise what he's trying to get across. So the most serious thing then is to withdraw from the balance of the divine will. It means hurling oneself into chaos, into disorder and into the abyss of all evils. Now, if you go to the book of Genesis, chapter 1 and verses 1 and 2 and 3, you're told on verse 1 that God created everything. Verse 2, you're told there was terrible chaos around the place. Now, why was there terrible chaos? It was because of the rebellion of the angels. OK, and then the next thing is God created light to start putting everything into order. Now, my daughter, this is why I have called you in a special way into this balance of my will, so that as you live in it, you may come to balance all the work of deranged humanity. Now, deranged means it's all out of balance. By living in my will, you will balance yourself and you will be in order and in perfect harmony with us and with all things created by us. So, since you harmonize everything, we will feel you flowing in the sphere of our will, which of course Adam was before he fell, giving us the order and the harmony of all the intelligences, words, works and steps of all. So there's your substitution and reparation for everybody. We will constitute your acts in our will as the rulers of all the others. That's to enable the rest of humanity to come back. And we will make up for the chaos of unfortunate humanity. Now, you've had several words there given for humanity, that humanity moved away from the balance, went into total disorder, deranged, chaos. Okay. So each act of yours will be the mark of the order which we will receive in the name of all the others. Now notice that the prayer is in the name of all. You have much to do in our will, because she was the first to come back. You will be like a queen, and will bring us all conquests and all harmonies. Our will administer to you all that is necessary so that you can make up for all. You desire it, I do it. Okay? And fill the void of the balance of the human will, which received so much harm in withdrawing from the balance of our divine will. Anybody counted the word balance?
6, 7.
There's about 12 of them. Okay. So in other words, you're being told this is a major issue. But it's also a key to discerning how we're doing. So if we still have points of imbalance in us, there's work to be done to bring us back into that balance. Is that okay? So August the 12th, 1922. I want to give you a heading for this, and it's the thread of the human will. The thread of the human will. And so while you're thinking of the thread of the human will, I want to remind you of something I've given to you several times before. And it is that John of the Cross gave the story of a bird that's tied to a tree. And it could be tied with a rope or a thread. But it's much more tragic to be tied with a thread. Okay, so I just write on the page to remind myself the bird enslaved by a thread. And you see, that's where we're going to be told. I felt oppressed and in pain, Louisa said, in such a way that only my sweet Jesus can know. He scrutinizes each fibre of my poor heart and sees all the intensity of my torment. Having compassion for me, on coming, he sustained me in his arms, telling me, my daughter, courage, I am here for you. What do you fear? That's Psalm 27, verses 1 and 2. The Lord is at my side, whom shall I fear? Have I perhaps failed you? And if you do not feel like moving the slightest from my will at any cost, much less do I feel like not being with you. As the life of each act and the pain, the life of each act and pain of yours. So the Lord is the source of the pain, but it's also his life that is in them. They're not just words. Now, you must know that my will is most pure gold, so that the thread of your will may become most pure gold in such a way that as the thread of your will is braided with mine, that which is yours and that which is mine may not be distinguished. Excuse me. John 14, 20 to 21. You and me and I in you. And also you have the image of the drop of water in the ocean as well. It takes only sacrifice and pains, he said. Consuming the thread of your will, they substituted with the golden divine thread, which identifying itself with mine forms one single thread and braiding the whole of the great wheel of eternity. Now, as we go on from here, he's going to talk many times about the great wheel of eternity. I'm just sort of saying he's putting it in here. And it extends everywhere and finds itself in every place. So what he's saying is your will is only a thread. It's a nothing. And yet we find it so extremely difficult to give it to him. And if we give it to him, he transforms it into pure gold. And this pure gold thread is important for the clock that runs the wheel of eternity, because in higher volumes, he talks about the wheel of eternity like a switch watch, where you have one sphere. And once that moves, then all the others move. Okay. But if my will is gold and yours is iron. Now, why would he use the idea of iron for our will? It's because we find it so difficult to bend. And we find it so difficult to surrender it. And that's why the Bible uses the expression stiff-necked. Because the will won't bend. Is that okay? I just haven't written down a whole lot of references because there'd be too many. Okay. But if my will is gold and yours is iron, you will remain behind and mine will not lower itself to be braided with yours. Now, gold and iron don't actually like each other. If you take two objects of gold, though, each one may have its own different shape, but by melting them, they'll form one single object and they'd no longer be able to distinguish the gold of one from the other. But if one object is gold and the other is iron, one will not stick to the other and will be impossible to form one single object. So only sacrifices changes the nature of the human will. Oh. Isn't that important? Okay. So I want to give you Deuteronomy 28:48 for a yoke of iron. And I want to give you Isaiah 48:4 for the stubborn neck of iron. And I want to give you Deuteronomy 4:20, the furnace of iron. Now, the first one was Deuteronomy 28:48, a yoke of iron. The second one was Isaiah 48:4, stubborn neck of iron, and Deuteronomy 4:20. So it's in this context you will understand why the slavery in Egypt was called the furnace of iron, that the stiff-necked wills or the stiff wills of the people could only be melted down in that horrible slavery. It's not absolutely amazing. So chastisement has that effect. Well, it's meant to have that effect on us, to try and get us to bend the stubborn knee before the Lord. Okay, a lot of scripture there, actually. Sacrifice is a burning fire that melts and consumes. So you can see why they were trained with sacrifice in the Old Testament, that the thing that was sacrificed had to be burnt. It had to be absolutely consumed to ash. That means, and they understood that this meant giving over completely to God. Okay? Sacrifice is sacred and has the power of consecrating the divine will in the human. Sacrifice is grace. And with its skillful brush, it imprints the divine shape and features. Here is the reason for the increase of your sufferings. These are the final brush strokes which are needed in order to produce the final extension and braiding of your will in mine. Now, this woman is at such a high level of sanctity that this scares me to death. I don't know about you. And if it doesn't scare you, you just don't understand it. No. That she needs this level of sacrifice and pain to do the final braiding of her will with God. That's incredible. OK, but beside that, I want to give you Hebrews chapter 10, verses 5-7. And in that text, the author of Hebrews, whose name we don't know, I love to hear people in church saying St. Paul's letter to the Hebrews. Paul didn't ever write a letter to the Hebrews. He only wrote letters to the Gentiles. And in that text it says, and he's quoting Psalm 40, and he says, at the time of the incarnation, that Christ said to the Father, "You've given me a body, and in this body I will do your will at any sacrifice." And so it's a very, very important text. One text is quoting the other. So Louisa said to the Lord, "Ah, my Jesus, all of my sufferings, as painful as they are, such as they seem to annihilate me, do not oppress me." That's very important. "And if it pleases you, multiply them for me." I mean, this woman is nothing if she isn't courageous, is she? "But you know which is the pain that tortures me, and for that one alone I implore your compassion, for it seems that I cannot go on anymore. Oh, please, for pity's sake, help me and free me." Oh no, from the priest. She's still at it. 14 volumes. Isn't that incredible? Now, which is her cross? The cross is the bit she can't take. The rest of it is not your cross, because your cross is something that you find absolutely unbearable. And she still, after 14 volumes, finds the priest coming to her every day completely unbearable. I just say, wow, it's fantastic, isn't it? And so she said to the Lord, you know, you can give me any suffering you like, just take the priest away. Yeah. And I would have thought, but I mean, by comparison of what she's going through, this is nothing. Mm-hmm. But as far as she was concerned, it was much worse. Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. So Jesus said, my daughter, in this pain also I will be with you. Oh dear. Is he going to answer her request? Mm-hmm. Nope. Why? Because he needs the church involved. And the only way he can have the church involved is to insist on the priest coming every day. And beside that, I want to put 2 Corinthians 12:9. Okay. 2 Corinthians 12:9 says, St. Paul begged the Lord three times, not in 14 volumes now, but only three times, to take away whatever it was he couldn't stand either. And it's usually called the thorn in the side. And the Lord said to him, no, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is best in weakness. Poor Louisa. You're not going to get this one. But it's not the first time he's told her. He said, in this pain also I will be with you. I will be your help and I will give you my strength in order to bear it. I could make you content, but it wouldn't be right for me to do that. My book says decorous. You wouldn't be right. A work so high, a mission so sublime and unique, calling you to live in my will, it would sound odd to me if I did not make it pass through the organ of my church. You see it? Mm-hmm. So the reason why I said what I said is not my opinion. It has to go through the church. The church has to accept it. Besides, it was through my will and through the intervention of obedience of a minister of mine that you were placed in this state. In other words, the priests have been involved from the beginning. If he does not feel like continuing, he can give you the obedience so that as you would do it to obey, there would still be a perfect agreement between you and me. In fact, if you did it by yourself of your own will, not only would we not remain in agreement, but you would remain disfigured. Why should have gone out of the divine will? However, they, that's the priests, must know that the world is currently on a stake. That's 1922, building up for the Second World War. And if they want me to raise its flames and burn everything to ashes, let them do it the way they want. That means take you out from your victim state. So here's the Lord warning the priest, don't you dare move this woman from her position. And so Louisa said, I remain terrified and more afflicted than before, but ready to do his will, naturally. With that kind of talk. So August the 15th, 1922, where we talk about the acts of Jesus and those of Most Holy Virgin in the divine will. This is a wonderful piece. Okay. So, finding myself in my usual state, Louisa said, I was abandoning myself in the arms of the most holy will of God, and my sweet Jesus told me, my daughter, in my will, you will find not only all the acts of my humanity, that my humanity did, in which I braided all creatures together. But you will also find all the acts that my dear mother did. I don't do the mama bit, sorry. which, braiding themselves with mine, form one single act, because her acts and his acts are in the divine will, so naturally they're one. As soon as I was conceived in her womb, she began the braiding with my acts. Isn't that fantastic? She was only 16 at the time, 15. She was 16 when he was born. And since my humanity had no other life, no other food, and no other purpose than the will of God, that's John 14:31, which flowing in everything made me the act of each creature, so as to give back to the Father the rights of the Creator on the part of creatures, and to give myself as life to all creatures. That's John 1:4. He's the life. And John 14:6. In the same way as Blessed Mother began her braiding with me, she too gave back to the Father all the rights of the Creator in the name of all, and gave herself to all creatures. Therefore, all creatures received, together with my acts, the acts of my Mother as life. Okay. Now, in heaven, she embraces all the glory of each creature. My will gives her such glory on the part of each creature that there is no glory which she does not contain, and no glory which does not descend from her. Now, there is your doctrine of the mediatrix of all graces, isn't it? They all descend through her. And since she braided her works, her love and her pains, etc., with me, now in heaven she is circumfused with as much glory as there were these braidings. With as much glory as were the braidings that she did in my will. This is why she surpasses everything, she embraces everything, and she flows in everything. This is what it means to live in my will. My beloved mother could never have received so much glory if all her acts had not run in my will, acts which constitute her queen and crown of all. Now, he said to Louisa, I want you in my will, so that the braiding may not just be between two, but among three. What is he looking for? A trinity from earth. Okay. My will wants to expand in order to find all creatures together in one creature. Do you see the great good that will come to you, how much glory you will give to me, and how much good that you will do to all? Now, he will continue with this kind of teaching in other messages, because he'll talk about himself, his Blessed Mother, and Louisa as a trinity on earth who did the divine will. So, August the 19th, 1922, I have a VIP on this one. So we're going to be talking about Jesus' interior passion. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, sweet Jesus made me suffer part of his pains and of his debts, which he suffered for each creature. That means Louisa suffered the pains of each one of us. Part of them. She couldn't hold them all because she wasn't the saviour, but she had her part in it. Her sip, if I can put it that way. From my little pains, I could understand how atrocious and mortal the pains of Jesus had been. Then he told me, my daughter, my pains are incomprehensible to human nature. No matter what we do, we're just not going to get it. We need to be on the other side to grasp it fully. And the very pains of my passion were shadows or similes of my interior pains. My interior pains were inflicted on me by an omnipotent God, and not one fiver could dodge his blow. Those of my passion were inflicted on me by human beings, who, having neither omnipotence nor all-seeingness, were not able to do what they wanted, nor to penetrate into every single fibre of mine. So the human is limited, the divine is unlimited. Therefore, the interior passion surpasses the exterior passion beyond all limits. My interior pains were incarnate, and my very humanity was transformed into nails, thorns, scourges, into wounds, into martyrdom so cruel as to give me continuous deaths. Now, in the hours of the Passion, you'll hear her saying many times that he looks as if he's about to die. And these were inseparable from me. They formed my very life. On the other hand, those of my passion were extraneous to me, ad extra, we would say. They were thorns and nails that could be driven inside, and eventually they could also be removed. And the mere thought that a pain could be removed was a relief. But my interior pains, which were formed of my own flesh, there was no hope that they might be removed, or that the sharpness of a thorn or the piercing of the nails might be lessened. To me, it's mind-boggling that he had all of this and the exterior passion as well, and all the mocking that went on at the cross. It's just incredible how he kept his balance and his peace and his control so that he could say what he wanted to say and do what he wanted to do. It's fascinating. But in his final breath, I just reminded people of this morning, in his final breath, the Gospels go out of their way to say that he gave a loud cry. Now, that was physiologically impossible. There was no blood or water left except a few drops in his heart. So it was physiologically impossible. His mouth was as dry as a potsherd, as you read in Psalm 22. So what you have there is the divine coming out through the human, and that loud voice was the lion roaring from Zion, and the earth shook. The lion is the image of the king. We were doing that in Jeremiah this morning. So it's incredible that, you know, you have all that control and all that balance and everything with this incredible stimulation. Now, with us little people, you know, we can be grand and we're nice and peaceful and everything until somebody gives you a sting. And the sting is an insult or, you know, a put down or this, that and the other. That's when you find out how much balance there is. Not when, you know, nothing is ruffling the waters, but it's when the storm out there and the winds are high and it's get at Francis Day. Do you know what I mean? That's when you find out. And so that's why I say it's under these atrocious tortures that he had this incredible... I'm saying this to illustrate what we have just read. He had this incredible balance and he had this total control. It's incredible. So you can see why he was emphasising the balance for us. Okay. So my interior pains were incarnate, he said. They formed my very life. On the other hand, those of my passion were extraneous or outside. Okay, they could be removed. My interior ones couldn't be removed. So let's come to the next paragraph. My interior pains were so great and so many that I could call the pains of my passion reliefs and kisses given to my interior pains, and uniting together, they gave the last proof, underline colour, the last proof of my great and excessive love for the salvation of souls. The last proof. My external pains were voices which called everyone to enter into the ocean of my interior pains, to make them understand how much their salvation cost me. Now, the church has known from the early days that we needed to meditate on the passion of Jesus to have some sense of what he had done for us. But it's only with the revelation of the divine will that we can go deeper to understand or somehow understand what he had done for us. And then from your own interior pains communicated by me, you can somehow understand the continuous intensity of mine. Therefore, pluck up courage. It is love that pushes me to do this. Now, in divine will, love is everything. Alpha and Omega and everything in between. Love is everything. Because God is love. And why would love push him to do that? Because Louisa is called to be an image of Jesus in everything. So August the 23rd, 1922, the soul who lives in the divine will contains the fount of all martyrdoms, sorrows and pains, but also that of all joys, contentments and graces. I was feeling oppressed and in suffering, Louisa said, as if my interior were in continuous act of undergoing new destructions and the annihilation of my poor being. So I prayed Jesus to give me strength, and he, on coming, took me in his arms to infuse new life into me. But this new life was given to me as the occasion to receive a new death, to then be infused with another new life. So she's experiencing this death and life, death and life, death and life all the time. Then he told me, "My daughter, my will embraces everything. It holds tightly within itself all the pains, all the martyrdoms, all the sorrows that exist in the round of all centuries. This is why my humanity embraced everything, each pain, each martyrdom of the creature, because my life was nothing other than the life of the divine will. And this was convenient not only to accomplish the work of redemption, but also so that I might be constituted king, help and strength of all martyrdoms, sorrows and pains. So no matter what we go through, he's there with us, no matter what it is. Just like he says to Louisa, I am with you in everything. If I did not have the fount or the source of all martyrdoms, sorrows and pains within me, how could I be called the king of all and possess in me the fount of all help, support, strength and grace? Because his martyrdoms, sorrows and pains are the support, are the source of the helps, supports, strength and grace that he gives to us. In other words, he paid for everything we get. And these help, support, strength and grace, which are needed for each pain of the creature. It's necessary to possess in order to give. Now, the next section, I want to give you a heading for it. Living in the divine will is a mission. It's not a devotion. This is why I told you many times that the mission, calling a soul to live in my will, is the greatest one, the highest one, and the most sublime. There is no other that can match it. The immensity of my volition will make all martyrdoms, pains and sorrows reach her. My own will give her divine strength to sustain them and will form the fount or source of martyrdoms and sorrows. And my very will constitute her queen of all martyrdoms, sorrows and pains. Do you see what it means to live in my will? To suffer not only one martyrdom, but all martyrdoms. In Irish history, we invented some things that we gave to the church. And one was the white martyrdom, which was living in community with people that you didn't particularly choose to live with. Okay. And living in community is like living in a cosmos of all kinds of characters. And if it doesn't martyr you, you're not alive. So that's the white martyrdom. The Irish also invented the green martyrdom. And the green martyrdom was exile for Christ, that you leave your country, exile for Christ. The one that they didn't invent was the red martyrdom, which was laying down your life for Christ, spilling your blood for Christ. So the white martyrdom is living in community and being martyred by your brothers or sisters. The second one was the green martyrdom, which we call evangelization or the missionary thrust of the church, that you're exiled for Christ. And the third one was the martyrdom of laying down your life. Now, in these volumes and also in other writings that I have come across, Jesus speaking to mystics, he speaks of another martyrdom, and it's the martyrdom of the heart. Now, it's neither white, green, nor red. I don't know what colour you'd give it. Okay. But it is that anybody, no matter what way of life you have, that if you try to live in union with God and you try to let God purify you and bring you to sanctity, that you will have a martyrdom of the heart. Okay. And I would think that for many, many, many good people in families, The martyrdom of the heart is what they get. And that is all the interior suffering that you have from the relationships in the family and all the rest of it, all the complication of that. Does that make sense? And he calls it the martyrdom of the heart because if a family is right, love is at the heart of it all. And the relationships and the feelings are very, very deep. So it's the heart that's wounded all the time, you know. Okay, so I think that's enough. See, the martyrdom of the heart. But I don't actually have a colour for it. You see, the colours were given by the Irish, except that the scriptures gave the colour red for the red martyrdom. Is that okay? It's just that when he brings up martyrdoms and sorrows and that, you know, many people would say, well, that doesn't apply to me. It actually does. It just depends on which aspect of it is the one you're brought into, you know. Some people suffer so much sorrow in their family life, they themselves wouldn't call it martyrdom, they would call it failure. And failure is just a wrong word. It is actually martyrdom, that you are being crucified by what's either going on inside of you because of what's going on outside of you, or vice versa. Does that make sense? But in the divine will, all of this then is raised to a much higher level, and you unite it with the martyrdoms and sorrows and pains of Jesus so that you can do an enormous amount of work helping other people. And you can also be the source of other people accepting the crucifixions that come in their own lives and letting the Lord purify them as well. Just wanted to say that in case you would think, well, I won't be a candidate for martyrdom, which you probably are. It might be already happening, and you know, and you mightn't just have labelled it, you know. So he says, do you see what it means to live in my will, to suffer not only one martyrdom, but all martyrdoms, not one pain and sorrow, but all pains and sorrows? I mean, one of the pains and sorrows that we all suffer from is watching our poor country go into disintegration. Yeah. And watching the apostasy that's in the church and feeling so helpless about it. Do you know what I mean? If that isn't a pain and a sorrow and a martyrdom, I don't know what it is. Because you feel so helpless. And that's one of the things that causes this crucifixion, that you actually feel helpless to do something about it. But in divine will, you can unite it with the martyr and do something for them up there. So this is why it is necessary that my will be the life, the very source and the life that's given to us. Otherwise, who could give her strength in so much suffering? And if this were not the case, how could one say that the soul who lives in my will is the strength of the martyr? Okay, isn't that fascinating? We might only look at the fact that the Lord is our strength in martyrdom, and we mightn't think that living in the divine will, he makes you the strength of another martyr. And you mightn't know the name of that other person. Okay. If she did not possess the substance of that pain within herself, how could she be the strength of somebody else? It would then be only a manner of speaking and an imaginary thing, not a reality. Okay. And he goes to pains to explain to us that what we're doing in the divine will is actually real. It's not just fancy prayers. And then he said to Louisa, I see that you're frightened in hearing this. No, don't fear. So many martyrdom, sorrows and pains will be repaid with innumerable joys, contentments and graces, of which my own volition will be the inexhaustible fount. I want to give you Romans 8:18, where Paul says that what we suffer in this life cannot even be compared to the glory that we will receive from the Lord. Romans 8:18. And this is right, Jesus said, if in the soul who lives in the divine will, my will form the fount of sorrows as help for the whole human family, it is also right that it form the fount of joys and of graces as well, because they're two sides of one reality. With this difference, that the fount of sorrows will have an end, because the things of down here, as great as they may be, are always limited. But the fount of joys is from up there. Now, as we go into the higher volumes, he distinguishes very clearly down here and up there. And that's very much in line with John's gospel, where Jesus speaks about down here on earth and up there. You are from this world and I'm from heaven. Okay. And in fact, as we go higher, he will speak of the earth as the low world. Yeah. So the joys that you get up there are divine and therefore have no end. Wonderful stuff. So let's go to August the 26th, 1922. I have a VIP on this one. The more one thinks about the truths, the more one reads them. This is information you need very particularly if you're teaching anybody else. The more you write them, I don't know how many of you write them, the more one talks about them, the more one diffuses them, the more fragrance they give off. Now, I've noticed that every single time I go back to teach a volume I've taught before, it's like as if I'm doing it the first time. And it comes to me new. And I'm getting a new fragrance from it. Therefore, everybody is getting it at a deeper level. I've had some people go from a higher class to a lower class. I won't name them now. And they were able to say to me, you're teaching this at a much deeper level because you did this with us before. And not only that, but every single time I see more and more scriptures in them. Every single time, even to the point where I prepare this stuff on Sundays, and on Sunday I'll see a certain amount. Then I come to read it again and say, I forgot that completely because I didn't see it then. And so there must be an awful lot more scripture in it than I'm seeing. That's the point I'm trying to say to you. Because the Lord says you need to come and come into this over and over again. Notice he says we must talk about them and diffuse them. We'll be back on that subject. So there's a VIP on this message, okay? So Louisa says, out of obedience, I was reviewing in my writings that which I had to mark so that it might be copied. But I thought to myself, what's the purpose of so many sacrifices? She had no idea what the Lord was going to do with her. What good will come from them? I'm wondering what she's saying in heaven as we're saying this. You know what I mean? And while I was thinking and doing this, blessed Jesus took my hand in his and squeezing it tightly. I love when he does that because my dad used to do that to me when he was teaching me the scriptures. If he wanted to say something was terribly important, he would just squeeze my hand. Yeah, and I just love seeing it here, Jesus doing it to Louisa. So he squeezed my hand tightly and he said, my daughter, just as the flower, when touched, gives off its fragrance with greater intensity, so much that if it's not touched, it seems that it doesn't even contain such fragrance and the air does not receive the balm of that scent. It is the same for my truths. The more one thinks about them, the more one reads them, the more one writes them, the more one talks about them and diffuses them, the more fragrance they give off, in such a way as to perfume everything and reach even into heaven. I'm sure Louisa says every now and then, did I really write that? And I smell the fragrance of my truths, and I feel like manifesting more truths. In seeing that the truths I manifested spread the light and the fragrance which they contain. Now, this fragrance I want to give you some scriptures for. Revelation 5:8 and Revelation 8:3-4. Exodus 30:8 and Leviticus 4:7. You could go on because it's quite a lot about the meaning of the fragrance of sacrifice, the meaning of the fragrance of prayer. And the Lord is simply applying that to his truths. The Bible talks about the fragrance of sacrifice and the fragrance of prayer. The two Revelation texts I gave you there talk about the fragrance of prayer. So Jesus continues, on the other hand, if my truths are not touched, the fragrance and the light remain as though compressed and they do not spread. The good and the usefulness which my truths contain remain without effect, and I feel defrauded of the purpose for which I manifested them. Therefore, if only to let me smell the fragrance of my words and to make me content, you should be happy to make the sacrifice. Oh, that's lovely. That should be written up at certain gatherings. If only to let me get the fragrance of my own words, why don't you just go ahead and share this stuff? Okay. I love that text. So August the 29th, 1922. One who lives in the divine will receives the grafting of the works of Jesus and the goods which they contain. So he's going to talk about a spiritual bank. Continuing my usual state, I was thinking about how much my sweet Jesus did and suffered to save souls. And he, on coming, told me, my daughter, all that my humanity did, prayers, words, works, steps and pains, is in the act of giving itself. In other words, it's in the eternal now, completely available. It's completely available to man. But who takes it? Who receives the grafting of my works? One who draws near me and prays, uniting with me, is number one. That person receives the grafting of my prayer and the good that it contains. Number two, one who speaks. Number three, one who teaches, united with me, receives the grafting of the fruits of my words. All of you who are teaching, would you ever take that on board? And number three, and in the same way, one who works. Number four, who suffers, united with me, receives the grafting and the goods which are contained in my pains and works. Isn't that wonderful? Otherwise, all the goods which I acquired for the creature would remain suspended. And not being grafted with me, she cannot enjoy the use of the goods that my humanity wants to give with so much love. Now notice, you have to actually enter in. You've got to do this stuff to really benefit from what he has made available for us. All of these goods are for our use. They're not to be put on a shelf with a nice flower in front of it. Because one of the mistakes that has been made by many Irish households is, and certainly in the past, they probably don't even do it now, is that they'd have a Bible on a shelf and that's it. But they wouldn't open it. They mightn't even have the Bible now. You see, you're not getting any benefit from that. So all these goods are for use. So they're not just for our possession to enjoy, because they belong to Jesus and he wants us to use them to give life to others. Okay. Otherwise, all the goods which I have acquired for the creature remain suspended, and not being grafted with me, she cannot enjoy the use of the goods which my humanity wants to give with so much love. If there's no union, the goods of one remain as though dead to the other. Now, notice that the divine will presumes you have union with God. I want you to notice that. Just take note of it. And if you feel you're not there, just say, Lord, excuse me, but you need to put me into a lift and get me up to the top of this mountain as fast as you can. He wants you there, so he's not going to worry about you asking. Imagine a wheel, he said. He's going to love this idea of the wheel now in future messages. The centre of the wheel is my humanity. The spokes, all that I did and suffered. The circumference, what are you talking about? A bike. So you've got the wheel of a bike. Okay. The circumference on which the spokes are fixed is the whole human family, which rotates around the wheel. Now, if the circumference, this second circle of the wheel, does not draw near to receive the connection with the spokes remain suspended and cannot communicate the goods which the centre of the wheel contains. So the bike's not going to work. if there isn't a connection between the spokes and the outer rim, is there? Mm-hmm. And certainly not if there's no connection between the spokes and the central point. I love the way he uses things that we've invented. I find that rather interesting. Oh, how much I suffer in seeing so many goods of mine suspended, which human ingratitude not only does not receive, but despises and tramples on. This is why, with great eagerness, I go in search of souls who want to live in my will, to be able to fix in them the spokes of my wheel, that is to help everybody else. My will give them grace so as to be able to form the circumference of the second circle of the wheel, and they will receive all my goods which others reject and despise. So here's we've got to keep the connectedness with the divine will. Otherwise, we can't help all the others on the outside, okay? Now, September the 1st, 1922, begins a number of messages that speaks about the seal of the divine will. So will you put a title over it, The Seal of the Divine Will? We're going to have a number of them, and this is terribly important because when you go to the book of Revelation from chapter 13, you hear about the seal of the beast. And the seal of God is given around chapter 7. I should have said that first. And the angels were told not to touch anything in chastisement until each one of the servants of God were sealed. And that seal was going to be their protection, not allowing Satan to destroy them. Okay. And they were not the ones that were to be given this terrible chastisement, because the earth needed these people in order to be able to keep going on. Is that okay? So this seal is going to be very important. And also to find out what the seal is. That's terribly important as well, because there's been an awful lot of talk about the little chip, you know, that's the seal of Satan. It's not nothing to do with it. Nothing whatever to do with it. It might be if you give your soul to the darn thing. Okay. So, September the 1st, 1922, love which is rejected turns into the fire of chastisement. Now, we've discussed this subject before, that the image of God is fire, Hebrews 12:29. The image of God is fire. That's Hebrews 12:29. Our God is a consuming fire. If you go to Matthew 3, now I prepared all of this and I'm getting the scriptures as I'm speaking to you. Matthew 3, it has to be around, it's down there, it's on the left hand side. I can't get, my head says verse 25 and I wouldn't trust that completely, but if you look it up, Matthew is saying that John the Baptist declared that you have to be baptized with the Holy Spirit and fire. I think it's around verse 25. I think it is, yeah. And the image of hell or Gehenna is also fire. So you have to look at this phenomenon, that the image of heaven is fire and the image of hell is fire. And the image of the Holy Spirit is fire. And you can't get away from it. This you've got to have one of the fires. Now, the clue for me as to how to interpret them is in Matthew. Because Matthew says you have to be baptized with the Holy Spirit and fire. Now, I know lots of people in this country were baptized in the Holy Spirit, but I didn't ever see the fire. Because the fire makes a huge difference, absolutely dramatic difference. The fire of the Holy Spirit, first of all, cleanses, purifies, sanctifies, and glorifies. It has four functions. So if people had received this fire, all of this would have happened in their lives. So it cleanses, purifies, sanctifies, and glorifies. Okay? Now, so it's an active fire bringing about an incredible fruit. So then your death can be seen as a little flame jumping into the fire of God's love. Does that make sense? So fire meeting fire. It's a similar fire. There's no pain. There's no nothing. It's just the fire meeting its source. Is that okay? Now, what Matthew says after that is that those who refuse the fire of the Holy Spirit will end up in a fire that never goes out. That's hell. Now, the fire that never goes out is an inert fire. It never cleanses, it never purifies, it never sanctifies, and it never glorifies. And so it's the complete negation of good. So that fire, which is very painful, actually produces no good. So it's a complete disaster. Okay? And in order to prevent us from having that inert fire forever, imagine if you went to hell in a fit of anger and it only got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. It's unthinkable, isn't it? I just give you the first example that came to my head. What the Lord does to try and prevent that final fire from having such a disastrous effect on us is that when sin goes up to him, you've already had this in earlier volumes, that it comes back to us in chastisement. The chastisement is the fire of purification. Now have you got it? Mm-hmm. And so you got the whole story now under one word, fire. That's where you'll study various words later on. Okay, so the sin goes up, comes back to us as chastisement, and that's the fire of chastisement. Now, the way it's put here in the heading is that love rejected turns into the fire of chastisement, because that love is God and God is fire. Okay. And the chastisement is a severe mercy, is to try and prevent you from having the final disastrous fire. So the soul in the divine will participates in the pains of rejected love. The pain of Jesus in of feeling suffocated on the cross, it must have been unbelievable. Okay. So this is very interesting. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, my beloved Jesus made himself seen all panting and oppressed. But what oppressed him the most were the flames of his love, which were coming out of him to be released and were forced by human ingratitude to be imprisoned again. Now, Louisa tells us over and over in the Hours of the Passion that Jesus was literally burning with love, and he would do anything to save us. But that almost everybody around the cross were sending him insults and all the rest of it, and everything was being thrown back. Even in our own limited experience of life, we find it extremely difficult if a gift is given back to us. And let's just take a very innocuous example. But if love is rejected, if you really genuinely love someone and that person insults you to your face and rejects you, that's a part of the martyrdom of the heart. Okay. Now, Jesus had this martyrdom of the heart, that his love was completely rejected. Okay. So his love was imprisoned again. So it's called rejected love. In one of the higher volumes, I can't quote it now because I've read too many at the same time. He says, using your own language, he said, I was unlucky in love. Mm-hmm. He said, I loved human beings who didn't love me. Isn't that amazing? How his most holy heart was suffocated by its own flames and asked for refreshment. Then he told me, my daughter, relieve me, I cannot take any more. Now he's using her own language, because she keeps on saying that, doesn't she? My flames devour me. Let me enlarge your heart so as to be able to place in it my rejected love and the sorrow of my own love. The pains of my love surpass all of my pains together. So this is the fire of love devouring him, because he wants to give it out in life and miracle grace to everybody else. So the heading I have for the next paragraph is the hardest pain of all. Now, as he was saying this, he put his mouth at the place of my heart and breathed hard on it in such a way that I felt it swell. Then he touched it with his hands as if he wanted to make it larger, and he breathed into it again. Now, the breathing of the Lord, Genesis 2:7, he breathed life into Adam. Genesis 2:7. And then you have John 20:22, where he breathed life into the early church. Because the early church was like the inert Adam until Jesus breathed the breath of God into it. So Louisa said, I felt as if I was about to die, but not paying attention to me, he would continue to breathe into it. After he breathed into it thoroughly, he closed it with his hands as if he were placing a seal. This is the beginning of the seal. In such a way that there was no hope that I could ever receive a relief. He said to me, daughter of my heart. Now he's calling her daughter of my heart because of what he's doing. I wanted to close with my seal, my love and my pain, which I have placed in you, so as to let you feel how terrible is the pain of, we would say, unrequited love. Constrained love and rejected love. We say unrequited love. My daughter, patience. You will suffer very much. This is the hardest pain, but it is your Jesus, your life, that wants this relief from you. Only Jesus knows, she said, what I felt and suffered. Therefore, I believe it's better to not put it on paper. Okay. After I spent a day feeling I was dying continuously, Louisa said, at night, as my sweet Jesus came back, he wanted again to inflate more the place of my heart, to give her a chance to suffer more. Now, she did say a couple of messages back that you can give me as much pains as you want. And she said to him, Jesus, I can take no more. I cannot contain what I have. And you want to add more? And he, taking me in his arms to give me strength, told me, my daughter, courage, let me do it. It is necessary, otherwise I would not give you so much pain. Evils have reached such a point, this is 1922, that there is all the necessity that you suffer my pains and vividly, as if I were living on the earth again. The earth is about to unleash flames to chastise the creatures. Now, this is the flame of World War II. So you see that fire is used for all kinds of images. Okay. So it isn't just God that chastises human beings. Human beings chastise each other in the most awful way. My love, which runs towards them to cover them with graces, is rejected and it turns into fire to strike them. Therefore, humanity finds itself between two fires, the fire of heaven and the fire of hell, in the fire of war or in the fire of chastisement. There are so many evils that these fires are about to join. While the pains that I make you suffer flow in between these two fires to prevent them from uniting. If I didn't do this, everything would be over for humanity. That was 1922. You and I would never have seen the light of day. Isn't that amazing? Therefore, let me do it. I will give you strength and I will be with you. That's your Joshua 1:5. Now, you do know that the powers that be are building up to World War III. So what we've just read applies to World War III as well. So in the next paragraph, while he was saying this, he breathed into me again, and I, unable to take any more, prayed him to touch me with his hands in order to sustain me and give me strength. And Jesus did touch me, taking my heart in his hands and squeezing it so tightly that he alone knows how he made me feel. Because if you squeeze the heart very tight, you feel as if you're going to take your last breath. But not content with this, he clasped my throat strongly with his hands. Suffocation, okay? To the point that I felt the bones and the nerves in my throat snap. That's something else, isn't it? So as to feel suffocated. Then after he left me in that position for some time, all tenderness, he came back and he said, "Courage, such is the state in which the present generation finds itself, suffocating with evil." Isn't that absolutely unbelievable? "And in all classes, the rich and the poor, the religious and the lay, the passions that dominate it are such and so many that the creatures are drowned by their own passions and by the ugliest vices." 1922. "The rot, the mud, is so much that it is about to submerge them. This is why I wanted to make you suffer the pain of choking your throat. This is the pain of extreme excesses." Wasn't that awful? "And no longer able to bear the sight of humanity suffocated by its own evils, I wanted a reparation from you. However, know that I too suffered this pain. When they crucified me, they stretched me on the cross so much as to tear all my nerves." Now, I presume he's not exaggerating. All my nerves is beyond belief, isn't it? "To the point that I felt them snap and twist. And those of my throat suffered a greater pain and tearing, which was such that I felt suffocated." Hence his loud cry. His last cry from the cross had to come from his divinity through his humanity, because his humanity couldn't do it. "It was the cry of humanity submerged by passions, which, clasping my throat, drowned me with its pains. This pain of mine was terrible and horrible. How I felt the nerves and the bones of my throat being stretched to the point of feeling all the nerves of my head, of my mouth, and even of my eyes being snapped." It's horrendous even to read it, isn't it? The tension was such that every small movement made me feel mortal pains. I would become motionless. And then I would writhe so much as to batter against the cross in a horrible way. Now, I've read that from another mystic as well, that the battering against the cross actually terrified even his enemies, because they realised he had to be in the extreme pain to crash against the cross. And every crash, of course, opened the wounds in his hands and feet all the time. "To the extent that even the enemies were terrorized." Okay, it's here as well. "Therefore, I repeat to you, courage, my will give you strength in everything." I think we should stop there.